Good morning. I'm Amy Wirth, Commission Chair, and I would like to convene the meeting of the Nevada Oversight Committee for Wednesday, September 10th. And in the absence of the chair, I will act as the additional committee member, so we have a quorum. First of all, I'd like to turn to the secretary for the roll call.
Good morning. Commissioner Bill Dodd, absent. Commissioner Bates, absent. Commissioner Campos, absent. Commissioner Glover?
Here.
Commissioner Pierzynski?
Here.
Commissioner Kwan, absent. Commissioner Sartipi?
Present.
Commissioner Tissier?
Here.
Commissioner Wiener?
Present.
Commissioner Rainworth?
Here.
Thank you. Yes, we have a quorum.
Great. Thank you very much. And now I'd like to everyone to join together in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Before we have the compensation announcement, I would like to remind everybody that our meeting is audiocast on the MTC website, and we look forward to hearing public comments on any of the items that are before us or in the public forum at the end of the meeting. If you'd like to make a comment on any item, please complete the blue cards that are on the side of the table by the windows. That also includes all the agenda items and background for the items that we will be covering today. So with that, I'd like to turn to the secretary to please have the reading of the compensation announcement.
As authorized by state law, I am making the following announcement. Each member of the board here today will be entitled to receive $100 per meeting attended, up to a maximum of $500 per month per agency. This amount is provided as a result of convening a meeting for which each member is entitled to collect such amount.
Thank you very much. Next item, we have the consent calendar. Are there any items anyone wishes to remove from the consent calendar? Therefore, may I please have a motion that's
second.
Approved by Commissioner Glover and seconded by Commissioner Tissier. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? That motion carries unanimously. Moving on to our next item, we have a contract change order, Fast Track Regional Customer Service Center, Xerox, and the State and Local Solutions in the amount of $4 million. And I'd like to turn to staff for the report on that item, please.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Beth Zielinski with BATA staff, and this item is to authorize a contract change order with Xerox for a two-month extension of the current Fast Track Customer Service Center operations in an amount not to exceed $4 million. Xerox operates the Customer Service Center under the current contract that was entered into in December 2003, and they are under contract to operate until September 2014. Xerox was also awarded the contract to upgrade and operate the new Customer Service Center contract, and that was scheduled to begin operations on October 1, 2014. However, due to schedule delays during the system software design and testing, the start of operations has been delayed 1 month until November 3rd, 2014. And so staff is requesting a change order to the current operating contract to extend it for 1 month plus a 1 month contingency amount in the event that the schedule does slip past the November 3rd date. So the $4 million encompasses both months. The operating budget for the CSC operations is included in the annual budget. And so any increase in the operating payments for the current contract would be offset month by month or month for month reduction in operating payments to the new contract. So it's kind of a net zero. However, we do estimate that the cost of operations will be lower under the new contract, and we would seek to recover this difference in a negotiation of the extension with the contractor. And so that is the contract action that I'm requesting. But as part of this presentation, I also did want to give you an update of the CSC performance. during the past year since the launch of the Golden Gate Bridge AET project, which has had some impacts on the operations, as well as what we expect as we move forward towards the upgraded system that is scheduled to be deployed in November. And so I do have a PowerPoint presentation for you. So the first slide is about the call answering performance, and I think we've presented this information before. So this is an update of where we're at today. This shows the volume of calls, the total incoming calls, and the calls that are answered by the customer service reps. And it also shows in the green lines how they're doing against the performance standards that we have in place under the contract. And unfortunately, you know, right now it's not looking great. We did see a dip last summer. That was right after the AET project on the Golden Gate Bridge was deployed. And that did introduce a lot of new payment options for customers in the Bay Area with invoices being sent. There was no cash toll collectors out there. And so this did have an impact on the CSC operations. They received a lot more calls, and they had a lot more processing work. So there was a significant dip in the performance, and they did staff up over the last year. And also we did start seeing a steadying out of the call volume, so they were able to recover. Unfortunately, over the past year, we have seen another degradation in performance. We're still seeing some impact from AET. We did relocate the customer service center in June to a new location, and there were some backlog that we had to clear out. And also right now during the summer, we're seeing a seasonal effect as more people are opening accounts. There's more calls, so we're kind of back to a very low level of meeting the performance standards. And we are working with Xerox to get the staffing up so that they can get back into performance. So that is the information on this slide. On this slide, this shows the call wait time and the talk time. And as you can see, the light blue line is the average wait time that people wait to talk to a customer service representative. And it has gone up again in corresponding to the call volume, really. As the staffing is not sufficient to meet the calls, there is longer wait times. So we saw that last summer as well as this summer. And there's also the dark blue line shows the average talk time, which has gone from 4 to 5 minutes, which doesn't seem like a lot, but with the number of calls we have, it does create a large impact on the wait times and the volume of minutes that the customer service centers are using to talk to customers. I would say that the wait time, while it is higher than performance standards and higher than normal, we're still around a 4 or 5 minute wait time. So it's not half an hour, things in that range. This chart shows the number of accounts that have been opened since AET started last spring. And as you can see, there is a spike last spring. It kind of came down, and then this summer again, we're seeing it increase significantly, particularly in July. And the new account openings is both fast track accounts, which are still higher than they used to be prior to AET starting, as well as the license plate type of accounts, which are used primarily for the AET program. This slide shows a history of the customer service center contract that we're operating under right now. The contract was awarded in 2003, and then Xerox began operations in 2004. So we're right now at a 10-year-old system. It has accommodated some significant new functions over the years. We did introduce the carpool tolling on the bridges, which had an impact on the volume of accounts that they were managing, as well as the AET program, which did introduce a lot of new functions to the system, as well as a significant increase in volume. So it's quite an old system, and it is difficult to maintain, and it's really not meeting the performance that we need and doesn't have adequate capacity at this point. So it really is time for an upgrade, which we're working on right now, and that will be deployed in November. We would have probably done an upgrade earlier, maybe a year or two earlier. However, we did have the Plaza toll system upgrade that we also were working on, and we didn't want to have two major projects that we're trying to deploy at the same time. And in fact, the Plaza toll system is actually older, or was older, than the CSC system, so it was in need of an upgrade as well when we did that in 2011. This shows some of the improvements that we will get when we deploy the new CSC system in November. It will be built on a more modern platform, and that will improve the stability. We expect fewer service outages, of course. And we expect with this that this will reduce the call volume, that the website will be more stable, and people will be able to perform self-service and will not need to speak with service reps. The website will be updated and streamlined so that people can find what they're looking for more easily. The phone system is being upgraded. It should be more robust. And within the operations itself, there will be new features that the system can support, such as tracking customer inquiries throughout the system, rather than somewhat of a paper-based system right now. So the management of service requests will be much easier and should be more timely to resolve them. Along with the new contract, we do have some tougher KPIs, and we hope that those will help us manage the contract and manage the performance, and that there's a greater adherence to the performance that we need. Under the new contract, if KPIs are missed and missed significantly, repeatedly over months, then the penalties will compound. So there will be more incentive to stay within performance standards. And then the last slide I have is just a picture of the new website that will be coming in November. We have streamlined it, and we're looking for people to be able to find the functions more easily, sort of one click from the homepage, so that they can get their business done much more quickly. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions that you have regarding this, or regarding the request for authorizations to extend the contract for 2 months.
Great, Beth. Thank you very much for that report. Looking to the commissioners. Yes, I'd like to turn to Commissioner Spearing.
When you talk about the anticipated benefits, did you set goals and objectives, and then the upgrade's going to meet those goals and objectives, or is the upgrade and you're saying this is what we'll get out? I just want to understand the process that you're following to try and improve the performance.
So when we originally put out the RFP for the contract, we included specific features and functions that we wanted to be provided under this new system. It was kind of based on looking at what other people were doing, improved processes that would be more efficient, both for the operations itself as well as for the customers.
Okay, great. Thank you. Then we have a request for committee approval.
I'll move approval.
It's moved by Commissioner Tissier, second by Commissioner Pruszynski. I have no public comment on this item. Therefore, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much, and I'll continue. Beth, please continue with your report on item 6.
This second item is also related to the Xerox Customer Service Center contract. This is a request to authorize a change order for $396,298 for additional costs related to the all-electronic tolling project on the Golden Gate Bridge. In February of 2012, a change order for $5.6 million was executed for the design, deployment, and for the ongoing operation to process the transactions for AET. AET, as I mentioned before, introduced sending bills to toll patrons who did not establish a prepaid fast track or license plate account before crossing. And beginning in March 2013, cash was no longer accepted, so all of Golden Gate's transactions are being processed through the Customer Service Center. Under the change order for AET, it did include provisions that the contract prices could be renegotiated if certain thresholds were exceeded. And while the project has been successful, it has resulted in higher call volumes, additional processing work, particularly during the initial months in the summer of 2013. And the thresholds that were included in the change order were exceeded. And as such, the AET pricing was opened up for renegotiation between BATA, Golden Gate Bridge, and Xerox. So after extensive negotiation over the past many months, staff recommends that the committee authorize a change order to resolve the additional expenses related to AET. And this includes approximately $88,000 for 11 months of additional rented space that was needed for the additional staff, $258,000 for additional network and computer equipment, and $50,000 for additional resources to provide operation support during the unanticipated spikes in account growth. And this would represent final compensation to Xerox for the AET deployment. And since this is a joint project with Golden Gate, Golden Gate will fund $287,000 of this change order, and BATA will fund the remainder. And so with that, staff recommends that the committee authorize the executive director to negotiate and enter into a contract change order with Xerox in an amount of $396,298.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the committee? Okay, with that, then, I have no public comment. I'd like to ask for a motion to approve the contract change with Xerox and State and Local Solutions for an additional $396,298,000 for the electronic tolling on the Golden Gate Bridge project. Moved by Commissioner Glover, and that was seconded by Commissioner Tissier. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? That motion carries unanimously. Okay, thank you very much for those reports, Beth. And we'll now turn, now our item 7, which is the update on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge East Span Project quarterly report. And I would like to turn to our Deputy Executive Director, Andy Vermeer, for
that
report.
Thank you, Chair Wirth. Andrew Vermeer, Deputy Executive Director of the Bay Area Toll Authority. And I'm going to give you an update based on a request by Commissioner Wirth. And Peter will help me out if I get too deep into the study of metallurgy. We've been asked to present on several items relative to the Bay Bridge project. On August 28th, the Toll Bridge Oversight Committee received an update on the testing program and the near-final results and recommendations. The game plan is that the committee will receive a final draft at the end of September of the report and recommendations. There'll be a period of time for both the public and the Oversight Committee to review that. And the goal is to have a Toll Bridge Oversight Committee on action for any potential remediation for the bolts in early November. I also have an update on the confirmation of our peer review for the maintenance peer review that we committed to over the summer with the Commission, and then a quick update on the remaining risk management program that's primarily related to the demolition of the old bridge, and then I'll turn it back to Steve to talk a little bit about the overall budget. As a way of reminder, what we have in this slide is the diagram that we've been using over time to show the different locations where we have the ASTM A354 grade BD bolts, which are the bolts in question that we have been testing and evaluating. There are several critical locations that are important to note, and they are on the bottom of the tower foundations, as well as the tie rods up on the top of the tower that sort of clamp the cable saddles. And then, of course, the main cable PWS rods, as we call them, are anchored in with these rods. And then the E2 has a significant number of them, including the bolts that were on the shear keys at E2 that did break. And just as a way of a reminder, the location where the rods broke have been replaced with a completely different option, and so there's no longer any of those rods in those two embedded shear key locations. The basic objective of the testing program is pretty simple. It was to investigate the fracture of the threaded rods that we witnessed, as well as to evaluate the remaining rods to see if there was any particular modifications were needed in accordance with moving forward the tentative recommendations that the committee had made last year. I'd like to just point out that we have been working extensively with a pretty robust group of metallurgical engineers. This group of nine engineers is headed by Alan Pence, Dr. Alan Pence, who is another member of the National Academy of Engineering. It's also represented by the other two gentlemen on the top row, Herbert Townsend, Dr. Herbert Townsend, and Dr. Lewis Raymond, who are really the forefront of the industry in terms of determining rod strength and threaded fastener analysis. The rest of the group rounds out, I think, a pretty broad group of experience, including Dr. Jeffrey Gorman, which is the BATA representative on the team. They are also overseen and peer-reviewed by Dr. John Fisher, who is on our seismic peer review panel. So we've been very fortunate to have that group engaged in the program all the way through. We have a series of tests that we've talked about over the course of the project, and there's about three of them that are represented in this chart, and they have to do with tests that we actually did on the bolts that were in place. And what we really have here in the columns are the various different bolts that were produced. You see different vintages, I guess you would call them, of when the rods were actually produced and delivered to the site. And then you have some engineering terms, both in hardness and toughness and strength, down in the rows. In simple terms, hardness is really the measurement of how much energy material can absorb before it ruptures. And toughness is the ability of the material to resist failure and tension. And so it has to do with the bigger number being more brittle, and it tends to break more brittly, and in lower numbers they tend to be a little bit more ductile and stretch. Steel has memory to a certain extent, and it can expand and contract accordingly, and is why it's such a nice material to work with. I would like to point out that the significant difference really in the 2008 rods from the rest of the pack that broke had to do both in the hardness and the toughness area. So the hardness was a little bit higher, and it makes a big difference in terms of numbers. A little bit means a lot more in hardness. But if you look at the toughness values, they're significantly different, and that certainly has played out to be some additional information that we have learned from the testing program. In fact, the committee would like to see changes in the ASTM requirements for testing that deal with toughness and also large-scale testing. That really is, I think, the most direct result from the work that we have done on the bolts to date. Now, there's a lot of information on this slide, and I'll try to discuss it simply. But on the left, in the vertical column, what you have is the ultimate strength of the material. And so it's anywhere from zero all the way to 40% stronger than what the engineer is designed for, and it's basically your factor of safety. The bottom measurement has to do with hardness, so the low hardness on the left and the high hardness on the right. So your goal in the hardness is not to end up towards the right, and you can see that we do have some of our rods that are in that location. The bars that are shown in colors represent the various locations of bolts, and so the colors are consistent both in the lines that Peter's pointing to, as well as the dots that are peppered up in the yellow portion of the graph. And the bottom part of the legend shows where these different bolts are located. And as I mentioned, there are several interesting locations that we're concerned about, which are the E2, the tower base rods and tie rods, and also the cable rods. And so we'll spend most of the time talking about that. The good news is we've got this slide repeating a couple of times, and everything is consistent throughout the slide, so it won't be relearning each time we look at it. But what you'll notice in the horizontal lines is the various different stress levels, and so that's the amount of load that is put into the various rods. The key is to, in this whole investigation, is to try to get rid of one of the three elements of concern. And if you remember, You need all three elements to have a potential for hydrogen embrittlement or stress corrosion cracking, and that is the presence of hydrogen, which we can't eliminate because of the bay environment, high stress levels, which is where the horizontal lines are representing. The higher you go in that chart, the more stress is in each of the locations. And then the third is susceptibility of the material, which sort of ties most evenly to the toughness and hardness discussions. And so the real game plan is try to make sure your peppered dots are far away from the horizontal line in terms of the color that it represents. And the one line I want to point out is the rods that we know most about are the ones that failed, and that's the red line. So that sort of becomes the marker in terms of maybe a median that we're trying to keep our distance from. That test result is on the full-size rods. So this is an unusual test, and it's the one I mentioned that we have learned the most from, and I think it's one that we would, in hindsight, have done on the rods in the first place. But it requires a significant apparatus and quite a bit of money to produce the test results, but it was extremely effective in giving us the answers that we were looking for. The next slide talks about an additional test, the Raymond test, that is done on small sections of the rods. And so it's cut from the rod itself, and then a series of laboratory tests are done on these small specimens. And the goal is to really use it as an indicator of how well the two tests compare to each other. And the good news is that what we have seen is both test results are very similar. And so they do represent the fact that the test information, both in the full scale and in the sample sizes, we believe is getting us the results we would like. The difference in this chart relative to single patterns is the vertical bar that sort of has got dots on each end for all the different colors in the top part of the graph represents the range of all the different test specimens that they have taken. So it's not an individual test. It's a series of tests. And so you do see the range. But again, it's showing us consistent with results with the other tests, and it's also showing that in all cases we have test results that are very separate from the stress that is in the bolt to the material properties that the test results give us. And again, the red is the results associated with the bolts that broke, and they are no longer on the bridge. So what does the testing tell us? Basically, that what we've seen is that the protocols have worked. They've given us good, consistent information throughout the tests, and they really do show a separation between the rods that broke in 2000, that were placed in fabricated in 2008, versus the various other rods in service. What we want to see is that all the rods fail close to that 100% of the failure design loads, and in all cases they exceeded what we were looking for. Some cases were closer than we would have liked, but we do think that the remediation in some of those locations will take care of eliminating one of the three items that is potentially present to avoid having any sort of stress corrosion, both near term and in the long term. The results indicate that you can also improve the capacity of the rod significantly by putting supplemental barriers in place. And so we have talked about supplemental barriers like painting or what we have called grease caps. And then there is also the dehumidification that is certain locations. Those are supplemental barriers on top of the existing galvanized system that is designed to be a barrier against corrosion. And so the goal in terms of the recommendations is to get to a point where you can add supplemental barriers where necessary to, again, extend the delta between the load and the capacity of the actual material in the individual locations. And so that leads then to the recommendations that we have seen in the I think you're going the wrong way there, Peter. The recommendations that we believe are coming from the report, as we mentioned at the Oversight Committee, they did give a very detailed and report in terms of the test results, and now they're in the process of documenting that with the actual report itself. But what we will see is that all of the rods can be protected from exposure to water with one or multiple versions of the supplemental barriers. And so the dehumidification system, which is already in place both for the anchor rods as well as the tower rods, is working. The paint system has been applied in all areas that are exposed, and we are also using a retrofit that is these grease caps that are very simple, sort of cap on top of the threaded rods that are protected in grease, and then again from that you avoid contact with the marine environment. But we are using this work to help us with evaluating how we will go forward with the maintenance program, and this will obviously be an area that we do pay attention to over the life of the bridge to make sure that we are following good maintenance protocols. And then finally, I want to just point out the two X's that you see in the upper right. There are two areas that they don't have this supplemental barrier. They just have the galvanized barrier, and so we anticipate that we will be performing some sort of supplemental work on these two locations, which are both in Pier E2, and this diagram shows sort of the external ones that are anchoring the box section into the bearings and to the shear keys. And so we will either put a grease cap up on top of it or paint it as a supplemental. The picture on the right shows the inside of that location, really just the other end of the threaded rods that are shown in the red circle. And again, we anticipate that most of those will be resolved with a supplemental barrier of paint and or some sort of a cap. So I think the bottom line in terms of the recommendations is that we do think the testing program is giving us a good conservative threshold in terms of the saltwater environment. We do think that the supplemental barriers will give us the permanency that we need to maintain the bridge for the long term, and that by paying attention to the way the bridge actually physically operates over the years and paying attention to that completed barrier system, that we'll have good success in getting good life out of these rods. I want to move now into the maintenance review. As you recall, we were asked to put together a peer review of bridge experts that actually operate and maintain bridges. And so we went out and used a resource that we are quite involved with the International Bridge Tunnels and Turnpikes Association. And they recommended that we coordinate with a group of international cable-supported bridge operators. They have their own association. And so we have a list of five individuals, as well as Eva Bauer, the chief engineer of the Golden Gate Bridge. They're going to come out and help us evaluate the current maintenance manuals, take a look at the work that has been done in all of the technical reports that have been brought forward, and to help us identify any potential best practices or deficiencies that we might have in the program. So they are right now reviewing pertinent technical documents. They're going to come out in mid-October for a couple of days and do a site visit. And they're coming from all over the world, as you saw from the previous slide. And they're going to focus most of their energy on the kinds of concerns that we have been addressing over the last several years relative to corrosion, painting, post-tensioning, and joints. But we certainly are going to take advantage of their expertise in managing big cable-supported bridges and bring those findings, hopefully by the end of by early 2015, to the Toll Bridge Oversight Committee. Finally, I want to spend just a minute on risk management. As you know, we've been talking about the bridge program for a lot of time, and I think actually one of the reasons why we're seeing some articles now in the paper relative to the risk management and budgets is because we had a pretty positive representation of what was going on with the bolts. Just as a way of background, we have, over the life of the project, had a pretty significant and comprehensive risk management program for this seismic program. We try to identify and quantify the risks and then develop work plans around avoiding those risks where possible. And we've been successful in certain areas and not so successful in others. But we do continue to work on it very directly. There was a significant program contingency that was established early on in the program and, with AB 144, and it was designed in to address these risks, and we have been using that and then reporting on the sort of fluctuation of that contingency balance over time and the challenges that we do face. I think it's important to recognize that we have retired many risks, so the self-anchored suspension bridge is really not part of this discussion anymore. It is behind most of its big challenges. We have retired risks associated with construction challenges and fabrication, as well as the schedule delays associated with it. But we are actively pursuing the risk management strategies around the extended time of the contract related to the demolition that really deal with the Caltrans and even BATA's capital outlay support system. As you recall, in July, we extended our maintenance work with the oversight consultants that are helping us. And so the capital outlay support is an area that we really do want to try to focus some energy on and turn it more into a project and away from a program. And then we are having quite a bit of environmental challenges associated with the dismantling of the bridge relative to bird nesting, lead abatement, some of the permit requirements, and also the marine impacts really associated around the removal of the piers in the bay, which is coming the next year or two. The risk management profile that we have shown in all of our quarterly reports is just sort of a representation about what we think the potential draw on the remaining program contingency may be. So what you have is an overall profile of a $90 million risk management contingency balance, of which we believe at this point in time there's a 50% chance that we will draw beyond that number. So there's a lot of ifs in there that may or may not happen, and the goal is to try to continue to work at the risks to avoid getting beyond the point of that 50% probable number and try to keep it within the existing $90 million contingency dollar balance that we show. Now, there's project contingencies for each of the various projects, and those projects are still within those boundaries. So we do think we have a decent chance of trying to address it if we can really deal with getting the bridge out of the way as quickly as possible. This graph, I think, is a good representation of where the program has reported well on the drawdown. And so the yellow line on the top is the actual program contingency as it moves down and receives or gets removal from it. The budgeted program contingency is the red line. And so that line, I think it's important to realize that it has been trending in the wrong direction since about September of 2013. And again, it's really related to the demolition, and we need to focus our energy on that demolition project. The 50% number is shown in blue. And as you can see, for sort of the first time in a long time since 2009, we are really now trending at seeing that 50% number go over the available budgeted contingency program number that is in place. I think it's important to note that the SAS has actually been trending around $2 billion since 2010, and it's still trending in that neighborhood. So, again, the focus for us is on the remaining project work. The game plan then to work on those risk mitigations is to really hold the line on the capital outlay support budget as it does exist today. We are working with the Secretary of Transportation to deal with sort of developing a better relationship with the environmental agencies that can help us work on removing the bridge piers in a more economical manner, or potentially leave some of the piers in place as potential public access. And we've shown some of those pictures in Gateway Park, and I'll leave with one of those pictures right after this. But we do want to work with the environmental agencies to try to expedite the demolition while obviously protecting all the habitat and species that are surrounding our bridge, and there are quite a few. Just in closing, before I give it to Steve, the pier reuse that we're talking about, this is a slide that we have shown in the Gateway Park presentations where we're looking at some sort of a public access into the water. It would reuse some of the existing piers, and that would also be a benefit for us in terms of not having to remove them. So there's sort of a public benefit use both in terms of the public, but we do believe that there is some nesting habitat that would be available for any piers that are remaining beyond that sort of walkway. There's also an opportunity on the west end at YBI to do something similar to provide access around the torpedo house. Again, we have been working with BCDC and the Coast Guard to try to find out if there are ways to take advantage of those opportunities and then provide a public benefit. So that's the storyline of the major elements, and I'll turn it over to Steve to talk about the program budget.
Thank you, Andy. Commissioners, good morning. Welcome back. I did want to conclude with sort of the tail of the tape on the program. One reason we wanted to bring this to your attention, as you know, the Toll Bridge Program Oversight Committee now meets in public, which means our meetings often end up in the newspapers, and sometimes you read things in the papers before I have a chance to tell you here. And that was the case on this issue. And so we are coming to you as quickly as we could to give you, I think, some context for the newspaper headlines. As you know, we have been working under a budget that the state legislature established for the whole seismic retrofit program, not just the Bay Bridge, that was established in 2005. And as you can see, it was about $8.5 billion at the top. Not too long after that, we went through a process and determined that two of the toll bridges that were originally not in the seismic program needed to be, and that's Dumbarton and Antioch, the two newest bridges in our system. And so in 2010, the commission actually acted to raise tolls to generate the revenue for that project, and we amended the budget to add $750 million for those two projects. And the budget went up, as you can see in line C, to $9.4 billion. Here's where the good news starts. In item D, because of a considerable amount of work that we did with the department, because of a little bit of luck that we got into a very good bidding environment when these two jobs went out to bid, and because of some very good advice from our peer review panel, which suggested we try to keep the retrofits out of the bay as much as possible, and we are now learning from bitter experience how fun it is to work close to the bay in trying to tear down the old bridge. That was very good advice, and it resulted in our being able to withdraw from the seismic program $350 million of toll funds and put it back in your bank account. And I count that a great victory for the program. And I think the reason that we were able to do so well in Dumbarton and Antioch is we were there from the beginning. With the Bay Bridge, so many of the decisions and problems had been set into stone and cast into concrete that we were arriving sort of mid-scene and trying to clean up the mess. In the case of Dumbarton and Antioch, we really helped conceptualize, develop and deliver those projects as a three-way joint venture between Caltrans, our agency, and the CTC. And I think we proved that when you get us on the scene at the beginning, we can do a lot better than when you get us on the scene midstream. So that's the first bit of good news. The second bit of good news was toward the end of last year when, as you recall, we withdrew another amount of funds, $130 million from program savings, that at that point we believed it was prudent to withdraw because we established that the remaining work, the demolition, should have adequate funds in the remaining program contingency in the toll bridge program, that we didn't need that $130 million in there. We withdrew it and we repurposed it, as you recall, to our Transit Core Capacity Program. And it, in fact, is going to help these folks in the front row buy a few new BART cars, which we think is a good thing to do with toll money. Now, we remain obligated and committed to pay whatever we need to pay to get the demolition work done. But I will tell you one thing. If we had left that $130 million in the contingency, we wouldn't have had that news story a couple of weeks ago. But I think we would have also run the risk of a much greater risk of spending those funds. And, you know, there's that old line that we've run out of money and now we have to start thinking. And I think that's the kind of discipline we want in this program. We did not want to leave $350 million in the program for Dumbarton and Antioch because we might have figured out a way to spend it. and we didn't need it, we withdrew it. And in fact, in the case of those two projects, we didn't need it. We, in fact, achieved greater savings than that $350 million. I think similarly, we think the challenge with the demolition and the capital outlay support item is manageable, and we want to manage it. And if you've got $130 million more in your contingency, it's, I'm afraid, just the case with human nature that you're a little less sharp and a little less motivated to manage it. So we do believe that the funding we have remaining in the program budget ought to be adequate. But it's going to require us to sharpen our pencils. It's going to require us to pull in our belts. And that's what we think we need to do so that we can end this program within the budget that was established now 9 years ago. So in part, this is part of my continuing campaign to try to rewrite history a little bit, because all you read about with the Bay Bridge is cost overrun and schedule delay. And that unquestionably happened, but it all happened before we got there. And from 2005 to today, we have been on schedule and we have been on the budget. Now, we run the risk now of screwing up that story at the very end. And that's why we wanted to bring this to your attention, and we wanted to witness to you our commitment to work with the department and the CTC to make sure we don't. And that the storyline that we've written so far in the last 9 years can last us till the end of the program. So that concludes our report. I know it's a lot of information after a summer vacation, but if you have any questions on any of the items Andy or I presented, please feel free.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for that, and staff for that thoughtful report, both in terms of the testing and the results, as well as our current financial picture for moving forward. So I know I have one commissioner. I'd like to turn to Commissioner Pruszynski and invite any other questions or comments from the commission.
Thank you. And that's a very thorough report. I was hoping you were going to ask us to be tested at the end so we understood exactly what this is all about. But I have a question about the I guess it was slide six, where we were talking about the recommendations for the upper bearings and the shear key, and those two we spent a lot of time on because of the difficulties we had in the rods at that time. Those are the two we haven't as yet done the supplemental moisture barrier. Questions two: are we at any risk in having these at this point in time not protected to any kind of deterioration? And then secondly, what is our time frame for the supplemental moisture barrier implementation?
Commissioner, those are, I think, very good questions. The first thing to remember is what we're talking about is a supplemental barrier. So all of the rods have galvanizing on them, and galvanizing is the primary deterrent for corrosion. So we think we're in good shape with the fact that the rods are protected with galvanizing. The intent would be to wait for the final recommendations to come out, but obviously do the simple things ahead of that. So we see no negative in putting supplemental barriers on top of those locations. And so the idea would be to paint and or put these grease rods on during the life of the SAS contract while the contractor is still around for the next couple of months. And they're both relatively simple and can be done if that's a determination. If you remember back to when the report was presented by the Oversight Committee, there was a concern originally that we might need to replace those rods in the E2 area. And so getting ahead of that and doing a bunch of work on those rods before the results came in didn't seem to be as prudent as waiting to see what the results would be. And so we are confident that these two types of fixes can be done during the life of this contract.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you again. That was an informational item, and I appreciate the detail and the comprehensive report for all of us to know. And again, reminding everybody that this is audiocast, and all the materials are available on the website in conjunction with this agenda, including the presentation that we received today. So thank you again very much. We will now move on to public comment. I have two speaker cards. I'd like to first invite Andre Carpio, and he'll be followed by Ken Bukowski.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, members of the audience. My name is André Carpio. I am from Aimeryville, and I have expressed concern in the past about the situation of the homeless. And as you know, every public place, meeting park or whatever, that include the highway, they all have sanitation facility. And as the population gets to be older now and traveling, some of them have retention problems, and so sometimes they need to get to area where they have to be able to relieve themselves, and going into restaurant and public eating place is a problem. So I think that I would suggest that all the highway be fitted with sanitation facility for people who are in need. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments. Now, Ken Bukowski.
Hello. Welcome back. First thing is that I have changed the name of the channel to Regional Video. So now, if you want to find this on YouTube, the channel is Regional Video. The other comment I want to make is the presentation. I mean, you have these slides here. I don't know if anybody can read this, but I can't read this, not even on the paper. So maybe you could use the whole sheet for the chart instead of just half of the sheet. It just made it easier for the public to follow. Thank you.
Great. Ken, thank you very much for your comments. With no further business, we will adjourn this meeting of the Bay Area Toll Authority until our next meeting, which will be on Wednesday, October 8th, 2014, at 9:30 in the morning in this room. Thank you again. Thank you very much.